Hello and welcome to a Min-Max interview. I'm Ben Hansen, and I'm very honored today to be joined by Drew McCoy and John Shiring from Gravduel, a new studio. But they're not exactly new developers. They've been around for quite a while, working on Call of Duty 4 and Infinity Ward, also working on Titanfall 1 and 2 and Apex Legends over at Respawn. So they've left Respawn, building a new studio. And so this is a fun conversation about what it's like to take all those lessons they've learned from the industry, working on so many incredible games. As they put it, they have a hell of a streak running here for successful games, going from Modern Warfare, Modern Warfare 2, Titanfall 1, Titanfall 2, Apex Legends, and how they're channeling all that into building a new studio. A couple things here. Drew calls John slothy, so don't be confused about that throughout the interview. That's mainly the main thing that you shouldn't be confused about. But throughout the interview, we talk about building a new studio, what it was like creating Titanfall 2, Titanfall 1, the overlap between building Respawn versus building Gravduel, because I went to Respawn back in 2013 with Game Informer, so it's very fun to talk about those old days with these two guys. Also talk about their thoughts on Blackout, the public conception that Battlefield 1 crushed Titanfall 2's success. A lot of fun stuff is packed in this interview, so if you enjoy it, please help share it with a friend. And without further ado, here's Drew McCoy and John Shiring. Drew and John, welcome to Min-Max.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's an honor to have you. Okay, your history together, how far back does it go? When did you two first meet? Like, really walk me through this moment.
Well, I mean, there is the fanboy connection from 2003. Slothy's first game was an independent PC title before indies were cool, called Savage, and I absolutely loved it. Buddies that actually a programmer who's at Respawn we hired during Titanfall 1, he and I went to high school together. This was after college, and we would play it all the time. And then when I joined Infinity Ward early 2006, a couple months later, I found out Slothy had worked on Savage, and I was like, I mean, I thought it was pretty cool before, but this is really cool.
Suddenly it's amazing. What is Savage, John? Is it as cool as Drew thinks it is?
I mean, it depends if you're Drew. It was a game that we released in 2003. It was pretty huge learning curve, had some pretty wild stuff in it. It was not a mega commercial success, and I didn't expect Drew and Mike to be so passionate about, after having made, you know, Call of Duty 4, Modern Warfare 2, that like Savage would be the thing that they're like really freaking out about.
Yeah, so I assume you guys met working on Call of Duty 4. Drew, were you there for Call of Duty 4?
Yeah, I joined maybe 4 months after Call of Duty 2 shipped on 360. So, yeah, the first thing I saw was I ran around a very French-looking European city shooting Nazis with an AK-47. And I was like, okay, I see where we're going.
This seems good. And I am a bit of a Call of Duty development nerd, and I went back not too long ago and read Game Informer's cover story for Call of Duty 4. And I love that in that cover story, they point out that, like, yeah, we noticed when the game launched, it was called COD3.exe, which we thought was interesting. Those weird days, there's a Call of Duty 3. And then, actually, we visited the studio, Infinity Ward, for the new Modern Warfare reboot. And they talked about how they're trying to make the Halo killer, how the team was split in two and there was the sci-fi project. But you two were both on COD 3/4 and not the sci-fi one?
Yeah. I was really upset that I didn't get to be on the sci-fi one, because that one seemed like it was going to be much more wild and different. And in the end, I ended up shipping Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare.
It seems to work out.
I think it worked out okay in that regard.
Yeah.
And just to give you an idea of like how different an era that was, back in the COD 4 time, I mean, this is like, it came out the same year as BioShock. Multiplayer wasn't the huge thing it is. I was the only person who was full-time on multiplayer on Call of Duty 4.
What?
For the whole project, yeah.
For the entire project, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of people who worked on multiplayer at portions of
course,
the project, and there's, I'm definitely not taking credit for it. There's a lot of incredibly talented designers who made all the great stuff in Call of Duty 4. But just to give you an idea of like the where resources were spent, it was vastly majority of it went to the single player campaign.
That's so weird. So you say it just wasn't a big focus. You know, I think about even the legends of games like GoldenEye, right? Where it's like, oh yeah, we cobbled together multiplayer, you know, at the very tail end, Miyamoto didn't know, and then we shifted out the door. And so Call of Duty 4 was somewhere on that spectrum as well, about like, main priority is campaign, and then multiplayer, yeah, it'll be great implementing RPG mechanics, yeah, that sounds good, and then that's the juggernaut.
Well, no, actually, I remember we put for a press day, and they were going to come out, check out the game, and we didn't have leveling. The game was very different multiplayer-wise, and that's what we thought we were going to ship. It was like March or April of the year we shipped, and I remember there was a train of press people coming through. They saw the game, blah, blah, blah. And then after that, Jason or Todd or someone was like, hey, we should do this like leveling and like, you know, unlock stuff and do all these things. And I was like, what year is it right now? Like, we should ship. Like, that stuff came in like last second, man. And then we knew we had something. Yeah, it was like
January. Like the last thing. Yeah.
Jesus. Yeah. So what's the development lesson there? Just keep your eyes open even until the finish line. But it seems like that's a recipe for development hell, right?
Yeah, there's a balancing act between always making sure you are making the most fun stuff you can make and sticking to a plan that you know you can ship. And sometimes the plan you can ship is not going to be a game that's worth shipping. And knowing when to make that cut is super important. I think every game that I've worked on, aside from Modern Warfare 2, had like a really drastic pivot moment where we go, okay, we've learned a lot. And it might look like a waste of time, but let's cut all the stuff that's not working and let's make a pretty giant change and go over here now. Like, that's the entire story of Apex. Apex was not a project that was dreamed up and then we started working on it. We were working on something else. Someone prototyped this battle royale on Titanfall Universe and it was like, wait, let's go there now. And that's a huge shift. And that's like every game has had that aside from MW2.
Was Apex kind of that story of just like, well, I guess we should probably check out Battle Royale? Was it met with enthusiasm out of the gate at the studio? Or was there a little bit of like, okay, I guess everybody has to go for it. I guess we can try and make a Battle Royale.
There were a handful of people that were super into it. And it was started because if you've watched any of our like behind the scenes talking about development of Titanfall 2, we talked about our action blocking process where we do all these small rapid prototyping. And it was like the summer of 2017, and a bunch of designers were rolling off of post-launch support for Titanfall 2, and they had their action block time. Like, go ahead, go crazy, go prototype whatever you want. And a level designer and a scripter made, it was called Respawn Royale. It was going to be our take on Battle Royale, but it was very much just, let's get Battle Royale stuff going in Titanfall world. And it was fun. It was crazy. Like the very first one I played, back then our engine couldn't do big maps. I think we capped out at 24 players and we had no way of doing like a drop type of system. So it was all zip lines crisscrossing on the high ground of a map. And so you just go and you'd zip line in and then you'd drop wherever you wanted. And it was cool. Getting some lively play tests, but once we had like squads with a really early version of ping, and some character abilities and started to like, oh, this is really fun. And then our playtests for the other stuff we were making, it was hard to get participants and people would leave the playtests early. That's a really good sign that we're not on the right track.
Right, right.
So it was born out of two people going, let's go try this crazy thing that, you know, we've been playing the Arma mods, like PUBG had just come out on PC and they're like, this might be cool, let's try it out. And it was before Battle Royale was a juggernaut. We had actually tried a version of it in Titanfall 2 a year or two prior, after Todd's kids got addicted to the Hunger Games in Minecraft. They were playing on some Minecraft server that had like a 16-player Hunger Games Battle Royale type mode, and they were just like stuck to it. So like, let's try this out. My kids like it, we'll try it. And we just didn't have time to finish it. But so we dabbled in it over the years, but this
was
the first time they're all eating
together. So there is a chance that Titanfall 2 would have done the Battle Royale before PUBG blew up? Is that what you're saying?
We called it survival, and it wasn't quite Battle Royale. It was more like one life and go find chests of stuff type of thing. It was quick rounds, but it was that kind of, you know, every man for himself, one victor type of mode.
That's wild. And then I remember reading an interview with you, I think it was on Game Informer, where you were talking about the tough pitch to EA to greenlight Apex Legends. Can you walk me through that? And by the way, we're going to get to the new studio, but I'm just curious since you bring up Apex Legends. I'm curious about that story.
This is actual game stuff.
Okay.
There wasn't actually like a pitch. It was a process. It was like a year of conversations going up to Redwood Shores and talking to EA, like executives and marketing people. And, you know, EA is really good at predicting the future for their games. Like they have sales analysis, they have forecasts, they go do lots of user research where they go and they talk to players and see what's resonating with them and what's not. And so we had to do a lot of that on this change of what we were making. And it was scary. It was not what they had necessarily signed up for. I was pushing for crazy stuff, like making it free to play. And so it wasn't just like hey, here's a really good idea, let's go do it. It was let's walk you through the process and the thinking behind it. And we had it was such a drastic change from anything EA had done before or Respawn that everyone was just kind of like, I guess it looks like it might be a good idea, but we don't even know. To the point where when we shipped, we were like, maybe we'll get 1 million people in the first month. And we got 1 million people in 8 hours. So there's just no way to predict what was going to happen. And that was the hardest part for EA to kind of get over the hump and, you know, give the thumbs up for the whole idea.
At what point in the industry was this? There wasn't a point where you could just pull down a giant sheet that just had the Fortnite dollar signs on it? Like,
yes, you can do that. Because, 6 months into Fortnite, it was pretty obvious that game was a multi-billion dollar behemoth. But it's really easy to look at other games and be like, yeah, but. Like, they hit the market this way. They're a super cartoony game. They have building. Maybe building was their secret sauce. It's like there's been games like this before that flop entirely. And then there's a trail of games that have tried to just jump on the Battle Royale bandwagon and they didn't succeed.
Yeah.
So there's also a lot of counter arguments there because Fortnite is something that was easily seen as an exception to the rule as opposed to something that you could say, yeah, this is a low risk bet. And so in the world of publicly traded companies, a risk that is that large is not easy to swallow.
So what pushed them over the edge? What do you think was finally giving up the green light?
Well, we did lots of play tests. I was always willing. Like, so when we were independent, before we got bought by EA, working on Titanfall and Titanfall 2, I got the reputation as the no guy within EA because I'd always tell everyone at EA no. Like, no, we won't send you a build. No, I'm not sending you screenshots. No, like, unless you're on our EA production team, I'm not going to tell you what game we're working on. And only a few people got to even see Titanfall games before they were publicly announced from within EA. And so during Apex, knowing that it required to get a lot more momentum within EA as an organization, I was like, well, come on out. We do a playtest every day. And I will hook you up and I will spend an hour showing you the game. And I was willing to just kind of be that salesman over and over and over. So they would send their people that they believed in that to come play the game. You know, there's always like, we all have friends. They're like, oh, if so-and-so really likes this movie, I'm probably going to like it too.
Right.
And so executives and VPs, they all have their game people within EA. They're like, oh, go send them down. Let's get their feedback. And then we were doing user research. We would go do play tests where we'd bring in 100 people, and they'd play a play test for like 2 days straight. And then we'd do a lot of surveys with them, get feedback. And every time we did it, the scores were going up and up and up to the point where it was, I think, the best testing game pre-release they'd had since like Battlefield 3 or something like that, something from a while ago. And so they were like, okay, all the signs are good here, but it was still just, it was a process. There was a lot of trust and there was a lot of tenacity on Respawn's side to just be like, no, this is what we're doing. We believe in it and we're going to push it.
Do you think there was some reluctance from them because you've been keeping them at such a distance? Like if they were involved the entire way, would they be more on board with it? But is it a little bit like, well, F you guys for keeping us at arm's length. So we'll see how it goes for the green light here.
No, the relationship was actually really solid. Like they weren't trying to get in. They were just when you're part of a bigger organization, there's this sense of openness. So which I saw a lot once we got purchased by EA and I was more involved with them. So they're used to being able to reach out to people at other studios and get a morsel. And so to have me as a producer on an independent, studio title, big deal. They're keeping themselves separate. That's fine. But no, EA always actually had a lot of faith in what we were doing on all three of the games we worked on for them. It was more just, it came out of left field. Which we had gotten kind of, I think EA got a little used to, like Titanfall 1, you know, the final hours of Titanfall that Jeff Keighley did.
Yeah.
Showed off like the single player prototyping we did. And I vividly remember the milestone review with our producer at EA when I was like, oh yeah, by the way, single player's cut. And like, what? That's not what we expected. And so got used to these kind of hard conversations where we have to lay out why we're making these choices. And then they can see the result of it. Titanfall 2 development was awesome, wild and crazy, and lots of twists and turns. And so I think through those processes, EA got to the point where like, okay, Respawn's insane, but the results are worth it. And so they kind of just put up with it,
yeah.
Even though it's maybe a little bit uncomfortable for them, but it was ultimately, they let us do what we wanted to do.
That's really impressive. Yeah, the launch of Apex, you know, I'm obsessed with messaging and how the game's revealed, and that entire turnaround was amazing. And specifically, I remember talking about on the Game Informer show, you had a quote to Eurogamer. If I may read your quote back to you, Drew.
Let's do it. I love hearing my own words.
Great. And I'm going to do my best Drew as well. No. So you said, we're doing a free-to-play game with essentially loot boxes after we were bought by EA, and it's not Titanfall 3. It's the perfect recipe for a marketing plan to go awry, so why have that? Let's just ship the game and let players play. That was one of those like amazing mm-hmm. things. Like when you see that kind of messaging from technically within EA, it's just like, oh, thank God. Okay, they get it. They know exactly what they're dealing with. And it puts gamers' hearts at ease, I feel like.
And that was honestly the sales pitch internally as well. When they're like, wait, you want to give it away? Like, but we could, it doesn't have to be $60. We could sell this for $20. Like PUBG is selling for $30. Like there was all sorts of like alternative scenarios. And I was like, you can't. The optics are so important here. We have a great game that we believe in beyond anything else. It's gonna work. Like there was faith there, and like honestly, I feel like I was putting a little bit of, I put my job on the line. If that game did not hit, I probably wouldn't have been there anymore.
And you'd have to go form your own studio.
Level of belief.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that?
I said then you have to go form your own studio. It'd be tragic.
Yeah, well, I mean, things happen anyways.
John, when did you know that you're ready to leave Respawn?
It was kind of an evolving process after Apex shipped. I started thinking about, you know, I'd been there for not quite 10 years, but going close to 10 years. And as the team got bigger, my role kind of got more and more solidified of what I do. And so after doing that for a while, I kind of was thinking like it would be nice to force myself to grow a little bit more. Because I kind of felt like there was this point coming where I could either just, you know, stay at Respawn, work for a really long time, become a super specialist and just, you know, do this really solid engineering and some management. But that didn't kind of seem like the way I really want to, like, let the rest of my career go. I want to kind of see the bigger picture and force myself to grow a little bit more. Around like Christmas time, I started thinking like it'd be nice to figure out what's next for me. I just didn't know what it was, and there was nothing out there that I was really eager to go do. And that was sort of where I was stuck of like, you know, there's not other game studios that I'm dying to go work for right now. Respawn is in a really good place. I don't feel anymore like, you know, like they early Respawn, like, you know, when it was this really tight knit group. If someone left, it was a big shock to the system. Mm-hmm. And as the studio grows and you get lots of really talented people, it's harder to convince yourself that like the place is doomed without you. So that kind of feeling of like, now might be a good time for me to go figure out what's next for me. I just don't know what that is. And that's kind of where I was stuck.
And then you're talking to Drew in the break room about this, or at what point did you realize that you two were on the same path here?
So I was on a slightly similar path. Wasn't quite as early as Slothy. We had time off in December, I think. And I just enjoyed not being in the office, you know, spend time with my family. And then I came back in January and I had already been, I had been switched my role. But Chad took over game direction on Apex, like after season 2 or 3 shipped, I forget which one. And I was working on some other stuff. And I had the same thing. I kind of looked forward and Respawn was getting bigger, and there were a lot of projects, and Star Wars team was great, and the VR project looked cool, but it wasn't that like small team anymore that I really, really enjoyed. And I looked at my path over the industry. Like when I started at Infinity Ward, I was an IT guy. Like I was like fixing computers and setting up dev kits for people and, you know, running network cables. And I mean, it feels like yesterday to me, but it was pretty rapid progress from that to directing Apex Legends. Like that's a 5-game ramp, which is pretty insane. And when I looked back on it, it was because I was always willing to jump in and do things that no one else was around to do, or they were already busy doing other things. And so I got really good at filling holes. And I looked forward and I didn't see a lot of holes that made a lot of sense for me to fill. There's a lot of things I could be doing and they would have been great and awesome. And I love everyone at Respawn working there. Like it's still, even though we're starting a studio in LA, I still think Respawn's the best place that exists right now in Los Angeles.
Oh, interesting.
Like people were freaked out when they announced I was leaving. And I was like, you guys are fine. Like Apex isn't a great place. This is still an awesome studio. Like we love everyone here. Like you don't have to worry about it. But I looked at it and I looked at what I wanted and there wasn't anything around. Like all the studios in LA that are AAA are either soaked up with existing giant franchises like Apex, which, you know, that team's growing and doing awesome. They just announced the Vancouver studio helping them out.
Yeah.
Or they're just getting started on things like the Initiative. And it's kind of, I don't know what's going on, but it's also too far away for me and all these things. And so I left mainly to kind of find out what the next step for myself would be, because I didn't see that level of challenge coming my way that was exciting enough to me at Respawn. And they were willing, like all the credit in the world to EA and Respawn. Vince and Dusty were always like, what do you want to do? Like, it's up to you. The world is your oyster. Whatever you want. Like, we're happy to have you work on whatever.
And imagine like the EA DICE opportunity with Vince kind of like overseeing that there'd be some higher position there that you could have tried to push into.
Yeah, but it's, you know, that's a group that I'm not familiar with. Like, sure. I don't know anyone there. It's a 2-hour drive through traffic for me. But it was like, I was just kind of like, I need a break. Like, I crunched like crazy on Titanfall 1, mainly just because it was starting studio as well as making the game. Titanfall 2 is a really hard project. And then I did a lot of travel on Apex as, you know, when I was directing the project because I was going all around. And so I was like, I need time with the family. Kids are getting a little bit older. My daughter's about to graduate high school next year. So I took some time, but I was like, oh, I like making games. And I looked around to see, and there wasn't anything really was like, that ticks all the boxes for me.
Right.
And that's when I started talking.
From the 30,000 foot view, it seems like, oh, let's see. These guys leave Respawn to form their own studio. There was the recent news that maybe a new Titanfall isn't in development. Are those connected in your minds? Again, from the outside, it's easy to say, oh, EA kind of sucks, and it looks like a new Titanfall project got canceled, so these guys bailed.
Nope. If we had any desire to make Titanfall, Respawn would have been the absolute best place to be there. There is the largest, most concentrated force of Titanfall fans in that building. Well, spread around right now because of the pandemic, but
yeah,
you won't find people who love Titanfall more than Respawn. So that would not, that would not have been a great move to try and leave Respawn to make Titanfall.
right, of course.
And I like to do new things, so I was actually really excited when we did the pivot into Apex.
Yeah, I bet. So it's interesting to think about your vantage point on the industry, seeing Infinity Ward, seeing Respawn, you know, I would imagine so much of game development is about iteration, and now you almost get a chance for iteration on studio design, studio, you know, overflow, all that stuff. Like, John, what are some of the pillars you're hoping to do with Gravity Well here?
So, I mean, ideally, or not ideally, but originally we didn't try to create a studio that was remote focused. Drew and I started talking, I guess it was like late February. And back then we were like, cool, we're going to find an office. We're going to start a studio. It'll be, you know, we want to make sure the office is a nice place to come every day. And then obviously our new reality hit.
Yeah.
So our goal wasn't to like really embrace remote work in the beginning. And then we were sort of challenged by it and sort of asked ourselves like, what if we did? Cause there is no near future where we're going to ask really talented people to come to an office building if they don't need to. So we are more focused on the, like, we want to make sure people have equity in the company, that they get royalties if we have a hit game, that, you know, we're not asking people to ruin their marriages or their family lives, things like that. Like, stuff that I would have a hard time, you know, going to sleep at night if I was like, yeah, I know that there's, you know, divorces happening in our studio, but we really have a milestone to hit. Like, that's it. I would rather just walk and be like, sorry guys, this is not the studio for me.
Yeah.
And so for Drew and I talking about what matters to us, it was easy that we were aligned on a lot of key things that were unrelated to the remote work. And we're really focused on like trying to attract the absolute best talent in the industry, treating them really well, and then just letting them be creative and talented and make amazing stuff. And the flip side of that is you have to keep your team size small, because the natural cost of a big team is that there's so many points of coordination on everything that people can't be as wildly creative. And so it changes the scope of what you can make, but it also allows you to be a lot more flexible, a lot more creative, try weird things. When you have a giant team that's like waiting on it and you're like, we're going to try this really crazy thing over here. And they're like, but if it works, then our whole pipeline is blown up. And when you have a smaller team, it's easier to like say, like, we know there's going to be a cost on trying wild stuff. But like, it's not a, you know, we're not throwing away $10 million worth of content if we do this pivot. And so it is a trade-off, and there's pros and cons to each way. But for Drew and I, it was very much like, miss having small teams, miss that like really tight communication, and, you know, moving fast, making quick decisions. Yeah. That really makes me happy going to work every day. And so we were both totally aligned on that. So it was fun to kind of dive in on that.
It's fascinating from my vantage point, because I visited Respawn for Game Informer's cover story in Titanfall 1 in 2013, and
You saw the old office.
Yeah, it was still very nice from my vantage point. I saw the pictures where it was all just like a bunch of garbage on the floor and stuff like that, and cockroaches eating Abby alive or whatever's happening. But like, it's fascinating to hear like how similar the talking points are about like, we want to stay small, we want to stay nimble. Does that freak you out? Do you feel like it feels like early Respawn again? Are you going back to that time in your minds a lot to try and remember where some things went awry? Because Drew, I even went back to like old interviews that we shot in that studio, and you said in 2013, like, look, I don't think Respawn's ever going to be like a team of 400 people. That's not who we are. We're staying small. And it's like, well, life happens.
Yeah, life happens. Actually, I think a lot of our values come from our experience at Infinity Ward and Respawn. Like, they were phenomenal experiences, and we learned a lot, and we want to keep a lot of that going. Like, not many people get the experience to be on not just one, but literally five in a row, like, hit games. And that doesn't happen by accident. That happens like from the people who helped lead the teams, and not just like Vince and Jason or Dusty or Steve Fukuda, who is game director, but it comes down to, like, I've learned a lot from John. Like, he's a lead engineer. He had people he managed, and that's the kind of stuff that we are bringing forward. Like, we want to keep those good times rolling as much as we can. And it just, you know, the two of us want to take on new challenges and see what we can do on our own with this.
Yeah. With Respawn growing the way that it did, does it feel like, looking back in retrospect, it's like, oh, maybe people had different visions of what this company was. We all thought we were aligned, we were a tight-knit group, but then at a certain point you realize, wait, you want to go that direction? I thought we're going this direction. And just naturally things are going to fray a little bit.
Yeah, I think that happens no matter what. Respawn was formed in a really interesting time, if you rewind 10 years.
A lot of lawsuits flying around, yeah.
There wasn't a lot of time or thought put into those kinds of like high guiding principles. We thought, we've been making games together for years already. We get this. Like, we're just going to start doing it over here now. But people all brought their own expectations, some spoken, some unspoken. And that was a learning process, you know. And I think that's one of those things that if you were to ask me, you know, at any point after shipping any of the games we've done, like, what would you do differently at Respawn? I would have rewound to day one and had the leadership group within Respawn set up those goals and values. We've spent a lot of time and effort on those types of things since the formation, but because on day one there wasn't like a solidified, like, this is why we do what we do and this is how we do it,
right?
It definitely caused people to be like, oh, this is not for me anymore. And, you know, I would have appreciated it for myself, because if I had known we were going to get to 500 people at Respawn, maybe I could have prepared myself better and, you know, whatever, I don't know. not that I left with any ill will, but it's like, yeah, that's the one thing that I think we didn't do well enough early on at Respawn. I don't think it caused huge problems necessarily, but it's one of those things that, yeah, that's one of those you look back and like, we learned.
Yeah, right. To me, the biggest cost of not having the total agreement on culture is it makes people unsure of if they can make a decision on something because they don't know what the right answer is. And if you can solidify that, you're empowering the team to just, everyone knows what the right call is when you have a fork in the road of like, do we prioritize engagement or revenue or say, you know, like all these different things that like the answer is obvious when everyone's agreed of like, what's our end goal here? And it's the actual price isn't that people make the wrong call, because I think eventually the right call is made. It's that the right call takes more time because people have to run things up a chain and be like, here's what I think we should do. Can you make a call? And so that's, again, one of the big team costs, but it's also a lack of like fully agreed upon culture of what everyone's goal is.
Right, right. The anti-crunch stance. How feasible is that? I mean, are there any studios that you two look at and you think they get it right? They understand priorities here.
It's interesting because I think you can get to that place of no crunch in a multitude of ways. Like I remember reading that Bungie had no crunch on Destiny 2 or an expansion for Destiny 2 or something like that, which is awesome. I love that they have put that effort into it, but they've done it through the lens of a really big studio. And so they have lots of layers of management and a lot of people who help manage that whole process. And that's not what we want to do. We want to stay much smaller than that. And so it comes down to things like, how do you plan your projects? How do you scope? How do you cut? When do you cut? How do you empower decision making? Like what Sloth is talking about, when everyone knows what we're trying to do and is bought into it, you don't have to have a bunch of meetings to make choices on whether you should make choices. You just, two people can meet in the hallway, have a conversation, and make a decision and go off and do that work. And so it's totally feasible. I think probably I crunched a lot on Titanfall 1 because I was wearing like 8 hats and I very felt, no one asked me to. Like we've had a very much like, if you have work you want to do, you can do it. And there are a couple times where we'd be like, okay, for 2 weeks, we're gonna do mandatory crunch. But aside from that, like we've always tried to stay really far away from crunch. And it's one of those things that I feel like it's totally possible. There will always be the necessity for someone or a group of people to stay late one night or do this because there's an actual emergency.
Right.
And you couldn't have foreseen. But one of the things I like to say is, a lot of people feel like cutting in game development is like a bad word. Like, oh, don't cut my thing. And I am actually like at most at peace when we're at the cutting part of a project. It's where I feel best, even though I hate saying that because I know it means there's people who have worked on things and they had hopes and dreams in them and they're now on the floor. But what it means to me is you've figured out what the game is. You know what the identity and the soul of the game is, and you can cut away the stuff that aren't required to make that game shine.
Right.
And so if you can do that early, that means you were on a great track. That means you are hitting all your marks and things are going well. And so that's one of the big things as well, is get comfortable with cutting, like encourage cutting. And if someone is languishing on something, don't try and just make them feel better and do more work on it. Be like, is this working? Should you just cut bait and run? Like, the good money after bad is a real problem in game development.
How do you have that conversation? Are there any strategies you've learned throughout the years for just having the most brutal conversation of like, yeah, that thing from the last 8 months, not so much?
Well, we shifted an entire game on Apex. And I've always tried to have an office with a couch because I consider myself a little bit like the team psychologist. People would come in and, you know, be like really upset because they just heard that maybe we aren't doing X, Y, and Z or whatever. And I'm like, okay, let's spend the hour and let's talk about this. Like, why does that upset you? What's catching you off guard? How will this affect you in downstream departments behind you? And like, help me understand where you are coming from an emotional standpoint. And then we can talk about the logistics of it and the realities of it. And and what I've found is every person's different. You have to approach them all differently when you have tough news like this. But if you can get to a common ground of understanding about why a thing is going to affect them the way it is, you can help them deal with it. And I definitely didn't do it great every time, but I think people got to a point where they could come to me and trust that they weren't just getting a bunch of BS, and I would be able to understand their frustrations and talk them through. And that's just one of those things that, if you haven't been a manager of people or a manager of a team, that's one of those things that seems really, really hard, because it feels like all you're going to do is rip a bandit off and they're going to be in pain and then they're going to have to send them their way. But if you treat them like a person that has creative desires and they have, you know, their shower thought that morning was going to be about that mechanic they were going to work on,
right,
and you've thrown it away from them. And you have to understand that that's an emotionally wrenching process. And it might sound silly, but I mean, we're all in some form or another arts. Sloppy is a programmer. He is being creative in his problem solving. And when you break down all that scaffolding and say, oh, that thing doesn't matter anymore, that has an impact. And you have to be aware of that human impact and just spend the time required to make people feel comfortable with it.
Yeah. So with the new studio, John, right now, if you had to place bets, do you know your first game? Do you know what this is going to be?
Yes and no. Okay. I know our starting point for our first game because we have a deck we've been pitching, you know, potential partners. So we have an idea of what we would like to build with. We do two things. One is we tell our partners the gameplay part, like all the details of like the minute to minute stuff is what the team will discover together. Like that is not, we're not the write down a design Bible. Here's the game. And the second version is, even with that first caveat, when we're done, it's going to be very little to do with this initial pitch, because that's historically how we've been. Of what we think we're about to make is never right, and so you embrace that. That's part of it, is like, we know this isn't what the final product is.
Yeah.
This is an idea that it would be good to explore. Here's some initial ideas, but we need to go prove it out and try things and let the team come up with their own ideas and change it.
Do you feel like you two are being bold with the pitch? Are you trying to make something radically new? Are you trying to stay in your wheelhouse? What end of the spectrum are you on here?
Somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
So we're setting out to make a game that will be a mass market game. That part is very core to our the way we develop and the kind of games we like to make. We're not trying to make like a art house type game. And we're also... I also think if you talk to enough people in the industry, you'll see there's a lot of kind of this feeling you'll get from people that like Fortnite is a weird outlier. And if we just wait it out, things will go back to normal. And I think that is entirely incorrect. I think Fortnite is an interesting game that comes out because other people haven't been taking enough creative risks. And their dominance shows that people want new stuff, not just like a new story in an existing framework of gameplay, but like they want new experience that are really different. Kind of think back to like the Guitar Hero era of just,
right,
like there were a lot of wild games coming out that were really different. And there's this like excitingness of like, I wonder what's coming next. And I feel like to some degree, and this is not meant as an attack on anybody in the industry, we've kind of lowered that down so that it's games that have really good production value and games that have much better story than they used to. But the amount of like risk taken in the delivery of the gameplay and the gameplay itself has been slowly dropping, and it's kind of due for bigger changes to it.
Yeah. I'm curious, Drew, what do you think of like Escape from Tarkov? Have you been studying that game much?
I have been watching it. I try to play it poorly. It's definitely not my style of game. I am dyed-in-the-wool, like, hardcore, fast-paced shooter player. So, you know, for me, Quake is life at some point. So it's really hard for me to wrap my head around this more methodical, you know, tiptoeing through and taking your time and thinking a lot. I'm kind of a dumb player. I don't have the extra cycles to think about anything other than shooting someone else as quickly as I can. But I think Tarkov is a really good example of a game that in the past we would have looked at and taken a lot of inspiration from, because it's doing really cool, interesting things. It's just doing it in a way that's not palatable to a large audience or a massive market.
Right. I would imagine Treyarch or Sledgehammer, I mean, certainly Call of Duty teams are looking at that for where we can go in the future.
Yeah, like the example we've always used is like Call of Duty 4, it didn't start with this, but looking at what it got to was, how do you take the addictive nature of high lethality, care about the angles, get really good at a gun or two of Counter-Strike, but wrap it in a container that anyone can enjoy? So Call of Duty 4 was like, let's take Counter-Strike, let's make it fun on a console. Oh, and then there's this carrot you can chase and upgrade and progress and do all these things. And Titanfall had a lot of inspiration from places you would have never expected. Like Titanfall 1, there's a lot of fighting game influences. There was original Doom and Doom 2 influences of stuff like a plasma gun from Doom. It's this really cool high rate of fire plasma gun that shoots projectiles. So you have to lead a little bit. And so like when we're doing weapon designs, all these things, we're like taking inspiration from these games that maybe to us as people very immersed in games are super aware of. But when you're talking an audience of 10, 20, 30, 50 million people, they have no idea. These might as well have been like buried treasures to them. And so extracting those really good things that we have identified as players and developers, and then putting it in a way that a lot of people can enjoy, that's kind of a lot of the MO of how we've operated.
Right.
Apex, great example of, if you've ever been in a clan of a team game, you know how awesome it is when that team is clicking on and firing on all cylinders, and teamwork just happens and communication happens. And so that's why I pushed really hard for the game to be a three-man team game at launch, and not a play a solo or duo or three or quad.
Try and push that idea.
Make it purposefully a team game. And that combined with the ping wheel, which made communication accessible to everyone, whether you were, you know, there's a lot of women gamers who just turn off voice chat because they don't want to get harassed, or people who have anxiety about talking that have never been able to participate in something like that. And so Apex is another good example of this thing that everyone who does it in other games really enjoys. We're now trying to make it mass market available. So I think Tarkov is one of those games that if we were still working on a military shooter, a lot of inspiration to be taken from Tarkov.
Yeah. So, okay, if I'm reading between the lines correctly, you want to create something in the shooter vein, but with a twist in how it's delivered or format, structure. That's the rough wheelhouse of what you're working on?
Probably a little weirder than that, but we'll see where it ends up.
Okay.
Because, again, it's not going to be the thing that I've written down. It's going to be something different.
Right, right.
You start wacky and then you whittle it down. Gotcha. You start as wacky as possible.
So the pitching process, you're looking for partners. Are you looking for full funding? Do you want to retain the IP? What are the mission statements here for partners?
So for us, utmost importance is maintaining control creatively over the games we make and how we make them. Or to what we want to do is empower the team to make as many decisions as possible. So we've had tons of conversations with all sorts of people. It's been quite the learning experience. We're both just developers. I've had a peek behind the curtain a little bit, helping run some projects, but never actually from the full on business side. And it's interesting because you'll find people who come from the investment side of the world, and they're just looking for 5-10x return on their investment within X amount of years. It's like, okay, like interesting, but you're going to have to buy a big chunk of the company. You're probably going to have some amount of say over how we do things. Some of them are all about helping small studios get up and running, providing them with HR resources and recruiting and help you set up benefits and stuff. Like, that's great. That's awesome. But how do we get to a point where I can go to someone who's been making games for 20 years and recruit them? And so for what we're really looking for is a full project funding that includes IP control for us, if possible, and the ability to actually hire the best talent in the industry. So we've got some offers on the table, which are okay, and we could take them and we can get started if we need to, but we're really holding out, not just for money, we're holding out for the relationship that seems like that will hopefully work the best possible. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean finding people who share that level of trust in the people who make the games, as opposed to straight, like, here's a balance sheet, here's the risk assessment, that is a green or red type of decision making. It's more like, no, we trust in you guys and the people you want to bring on and your mission statement for your studio, and we're going to be there to back you up.
Yeah, it seems like, again, from the outside, it's like, well, it seems like Epic is throwing around the best deals in the industry. Is that too weird? Was there a rivalry between Apex Legends and Fortnite, so it seems bizarre, or are you happy to have those conversations?
No, it's players like to think that games are pitted against each other. The reality is the industry is so small, we all love each other, and we're all just happy to play fun games. And so, yeah, we know a lot of people at Epic, and they're good friends, and there is no bad blood anywhere, as far as I can tell.
Gotcha. Hey, on that note, what do you think of Warzone, Call of Duty's Battle Royale?
You know what? I thought Blackout was really good.
Yeah.
When it came out, I had a little bit of like a uh-oh moment because it was much more engaging than I expected it to be. You know, we all heard the stories about Treyarch, you know, having to build that in a short period of time after canceling single player.
And Raven having to bust his ass.
They're going to tick some boxes, but those poor guys, they didn't have time to really get in there. And so when I played Blackout, I was like, dang, we got our work cut out for us. And then when Warzone was being, you know, leaked, teased, whatever you want to call it, I was like, okay, here comes the one that they spent all their time on. And they, as far as I'm concerned, they did a great job. Like, it's after I played a lot of Warzone, I went back to Blackout and I was like, oh, wow, this is like a huge step up. Like, bravo to you guys. Like, you guys just keep improving. I thought Modern Warfare as a whole package was the best Call of Duty in a long time. Like, we got buddies over there. They totally killed it. I think Warzone, I love that how much new stuff they're trying to bring in. Like the Gulag 1v1 sequence is a really interesting idea.
Yeah.
Bringing in actual perks and, you know, kill streaks and things like that. They're like, okay, cool. I'm liking that the games are finding the differentiator even within the space of Battle Royale even more. My concern was that with Apex and Fortnite and PUBG still huge in Asia, that everyone else would kind of stop chasing and finding new things in that space. And I know it's cliche on the internet to say battle royales, that's all anyone makes anymore. But if you actually look at the landscape, there's not that many options out there.
Right.
And I was going to be really sad if there wasn't innovation happening in that space. I'm excited as a player that it's still happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So going back to Respawn's design philosophies of having like, what'd you call it? The prototyping phase? What was the
action blocks?
Action blocks. Is that a structure you want to pull forward with the new studio, is to have that downtime for everybody to be creative and see what comes out of it?
Yeah, and it's interesting because action blocks were born during Titanfall 2 when we already had a structure. We had a universe, we had weapons, we had titans, we had level chunks people could reuse. So it was more of a way to find what does single player in Titanfall look like? Because you got to remember, this is before we had any cool single player stuff. So you had a very defined lane. There wasn't complete craziness, like go make a kart racer type of openness. And so you can't really one-to-one use that for a brand new game. But you can use the thought process behind how it worked, in that you give people a limited window of time. You say, I don't care what it looks like. I don't care if it's just a bunch of blocks, but make something that's expressing an idea you have. And that could be a mechanic, that could be an encounter, that could be a storytelling method. Like the Titanfall 2 Jack and BT dialogue was an action block. And the prototypes can span the gamut, as well as the time travel level was a action block. He took a multiplayer level from Titanfall 1 and made it destroyed in a clean version. It was super ghetto, but immediately you're like, oh, this is going to be a thing, and you know what to start working on. So when we start our first project, once we are prototyping, I'm really excited to give that level of freedom because we still have that high level game pitch idea. So people will be walking in the same direction, but the lane is much, much wider. And that's where it's scary because you never know what you're going to get. But I'm also super excited because, you know, people who've been making games for the length of time that we are recruiting, they have a lot of pent up ideas. They have a lot of creativity that's just waiting to come out. And some of it's going to be awful. Some of it's going to be like mind blowing, and I can't wait to sift through it all.
Yeah. The pent up ideas thing is interesting. Correct me if I'm wrong, again, 30,000 foot view, but it seems like that's one of the reasons the campaign for Titanfall 2 is the best shooter campaign of all time, is it feels like the team had so many pent up ideas going into it, and then like maybe even some scrapped ideas from Titanfall 1's campaign. Is that the idea? Is just the studio is ready to go. They had the tech down at that point, and now is just let's just cherry pick all these crazy prototypes and just make it level after level after level after level.
Yeah, it was actually we had tried some other things, structures that there's some vestiges left in the shipping game that you can pick up on. Like we tried to have more open areas where you kind of traverse back and forth, like a mini Metroidvania feel within a level. So like the beacon level where you get the thing that activates switches remotely, and then you have like the cool wall running gauntlet and stuff. And so there was like a little spoke you went down into and got that and came back out. So there's pieces of that left in. But really, we hadn't gotten to the point where we knew what this game is going to be. And this was one of those pivot points I was talking about earlier, where games changed drastically during development, where we had, I don't know, 14 months left on the project, and we had very little progress on single player. And so we said, all right, scrap all this other stuff. We're going to spend, I think it was like 6 weeks, and designers just cranked out something like 150 or 200 action blocks. And every week we'd play them, and we would, you know, the design team would play them. They'd get a spreadsheet. We would rate them, each person, and then give a score. So afterwards, we could see the ones that, you know, were cream of the crop, which ones rose up. And then that kind of helped solidify, like, okay, well, we're going to have a level that you're going to do these things. Meanwhile, writers and Steve are figuring out what a potential story could be to stitch all this together. We had a bunch of assets built from previous stuff that we were like, okay, so we've got a bunch of jungle assets, so we're going to make these things into the jungle level. And that's kind of the process we've always had of, even if something gets cut, it's not dead. We bring stuff back in various forms all the time. A good example of that would be the supply ship in Apex on King's Canyon. You'll have a big flying thing with a turret on it.
Yeah.
That was cut content from a different game that never shipped, and tons of work went into the assets. It went into the system to make it fly around and, you know, hit points on the map and do all these things, have players walking around on it. And it was cut like 9 months before we even thought, like, hey, we need something cool at the beginning of the match for people to fight over. And so we bring these things back and we revive them from the dead. And so the same thing with action blocks. Once you know kind of where you're going with it, you can look at what's on the store shelf and be like, aha, let's finish the last 30% of this, tie them together.
Gotcha. So an early version of Titanfall 2, it was just more open, or more, how would you characterize the early versions of that thing?
It was less directed, and it was more figure your way through it. Best I can describe would be like a mini Metroidvania. Get better double jump. Now you can get past this chasm, and then you can keep going.
Which there's, you some kind part of
that do exist, but not a lot.
Right, and I feel like you guys then got to flex that with Jedi Fallen Order. Like, okay, let's actually make something a little more in this vein here.
Surprisingly, the lead designer from Titanfall 1 and was on early Titanfall 2 was a senior lead designer on Star Wars for a few years before he moved to the Pacific Northwest. So there's a through line there.
Gotcha. It's so crazy then to think about the more open, probably slower paced overall, and then to think about the Titanfall 2 campaign that you shipped, which is like, oh, like the amazing thing is the pacing, how it just never lets up. It just feels like a greatest hits game. That you're just flying through, but that was a late development.
Yeah.
Mind-boggling.
Sure. The game came in scorching hot.
Well, I remember in E3 2016, I interviewed you, and you were talking all about multiplayer at that point, and then mentioned like, oh, by the way, there'll be a single player. And I said, how are you going to get that done? And just recently went back and watched this interview, and you're like, oh, we just won't sleep. Was that how it ended up? Is nobody on the team slept, or just you two didn't? Or
there was more crunching on that game than we would have ever wanted. And Vincent Dusty Studio has really saw the effort we put into, and they actually, for our launch party, they flew the entire development team and their spouses and some significant others out to Hawaii for a party on Maui. They were like, you guys killed it. You pulled a rabbit out of your hat. Here you go. Here's an awesome, you know, 3 or 4 days in Hawaii for you and your family. So it was more work than we would have ever wanted to have people do. But in the end, I think everyone's really, like, for me, it's one of the most proud experiences of my life to have shipped that game. I still look back at it just like, oh my God, how did we do that? That's amazing.
I'd imagine both of you still get tweets about like, hey, by the way, Titanfall 2, just discovering it now. It turns out that game's awesome.
Yeah, it still happens.
That's so weird. Again, 30,000 foot view. What was it like having that release schedule and then having it released 1 week after Battlefield 1? Popular wisdom is that crushed you guys. Is that the internal wisdom as well?
I don't know, Sloppy, what do you think? You watched the numbers more than I did.
I mean, so it's hard because there were a lot of games coming out in the fall, and yeah. After the fact, it seems obvious that Battlefield was a juggernaut from their E3 or EA Play announcement. But when you're planning all that ahead, and obviously release dates are set long before you announce your game, it was hard to really figure out which one was going to be the big winner. There was, as you said, the Call of Duty, there's Battlefield, there's a few other games that were coming out. So it seemed perilous no matter what happened. Definitely it was amazing to go to that EA Play with Titanfall 2 and get really excited and then see just that amazing trailer for Battlefield 1. It was kind of a shock for me personally. And it's partially just that DICE does really, really good trailers.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a trailer that was nearly as good for that EA Play.
And so he said, yeah, come play it. Come play it. It plays well, I promise.
Yeah, I think for looking back on it, trying not to wear any kind of rose-tinted or not glasses, and Titanfall 2 had legs. Like, people kept discovering it and kept discovering it, and it goes on sale, or like it went on PS Plus free game late last year. And at this point, like, it's got so many more players than I would have thought given that initial launch. And sure, it didn't make as much money because they weren't all sold at $60 in the launch window and all that kind of stuff, but it found its audience. Like, it has a rabid fan base that is just like, I can't get this anywhere else. And I know what they feel like because I've been dying for a new Shogo for like 21 years or whatever it is. Like, it's I get it. I think it hurt us in the sense that multiplayer competitive games are a very nearly zero-sum situation to players. If you're not one of the top five most played shooters in the online space, you're a quote-unquote dead game. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because players convince their friends not to play. Like, the game's dead. Don't play it. Come play this other thing that everyone else is on with me. Everyone wants to be in the popular crowd. So even though we provided what I felt was a really well-rounded package, and by the time we finished post-launch support, we had a really upgraded Frontier Defense from Titanfall 1. We had done a bunch of really cool stuff, and you know, the Monarch Titan and a bunch of game modes and things. It still never had that that collection of people early enough on to maintain its momentum in the online space. And it's interesting because Titanfall was never envisioned to be this competitive esports, like play this game for 10,000 hours type of experience. It was actually like the original Titanfall sales pitch internally was no shooter for old men, meaning we want to make a crazy multiplayer first person shooter that even if you're not 16 years old, cracked out on Red Bull, you can still have fun and feel like you're a badass. So that's why we made you be able to wall run dump jump. It feels really good and it doesn't require hardly any skill. The smart pistol makes you feel really great, taken out really quickly. The Titan is basically a really high production value quad damage feel from, you know, it's like, I got to stomp on the squishy guys and blow a bunch of stuff up. Like, it was all meant to be this power fantasy that doesn't require the utmost skill just to have fun. Now, it requires a ton of skill to be really good at it.
Yeah.
But because of that, it's not a game where it's meant to be played for 10,000 hours and you become perfect, perfect, perfect. Our hardcore players are probably screaming right now if they're listening to me because they're like, what? No, you guys totally didn't understand. It's like, no, you are the outlier. Like, a lot of people got their 20 hours of chaotic fun and then they moved on. And I look at that like, job well done. Like, we gave people exactly what we were trying to give them.
Yeah.
They think that only on it. They like, I vividly remember Gamescom 2013 where public first got their chance to play Titanfall 1. And I would go sit down for an interview after someone, like a press person's session, and all they'd want to do is tell me what they played. Oh, then I ejected and I was shooting a guy in air and then I rodeoed a Titan. And I'm like, okay, cool. But you got any questions? Like, I know the game. I've played it.
That was cool, wasn't it? Yeah.
So I think from that perspective, Titanfall really hit every possible mark that we set out for it.
And so in the long run, maybe it ended up toppling Battlefield 1 in terms of public sentiment?
Oh, no. Battlefield 1 was a juggernaut.
But like, not sales-wise. Not sales-wise. I'm talking culturally.
Oh, well, it's interesting because you're talking about one and an entry of like 12 of a franchise or however many downloads they've made.
Yeah.
And so I'm sorry, there is sirens going on around me.
That's all right. We had a lot more earlier with John.
So you can do a little RTX enabled tag if you want. But so anyways, go back to Titanfall 2 versus Battlefield. I look at that and a lot of people, like you said, common wisdom is we got crushed. Like, you know, the game didn't get a proper chance. And I'm like, no, we had millions of people come through our door, play our game, give us the highest user rating of any EA game at the time. The EA, like I said, EA does a lot of market research.
Yeah.
So a certain percentage of players who have opted into these kinds of emails, they get a survey and they are essentially asked really simple questions like, would you recommend this game to a friend? That kind of stuff, like maybe two or three questions. And that gives you a score of sentiment. Is it positive or negative and how much? And Titanfall 2, for the longest time, I actually can tell maybe Apex, had the highest score in that index from any EA game, I think for like 10 or 15 years, since like Mass Effect 2 or something. And so people came in, they played the game for a few hours, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 hours, and loved it and left. And like, great, that's exactly what we actually built. And so I don't ascribe to the, oh, we got screwed over by Battlefield or EA or this and that. Like, yeah, we set a launch date. Battlefield pushed a little bit, but not like crazy. They came out a couple weeks later than they anticipated, you know, 18 months before they shipped.
Mm-hmm.
Big deal. It was just not a game that was actually trying to be a 10,000 for most players.
Interesting.
And that's,
yeah, I mean, I think the lesson that everyone's learned, hopefully since then, is that the way to make your game a 10,000-hour game is to do live service, and you change it constantly and have big seasons dropping and all these big events. That's what you do if you want the game that people play for 2 years. It's not like if we had changed the design a little bit and tweaked some more thing, like ship it, and it just would have had this like huge boost behind it and people would have never quit playing. I don't think that's how people play.
Yeah, yeah. And there wasn't a kicking a table going, damn it, EA, why don't you separate these a little bit more?
I mean, it would have been nice, but again, yeah. I don't think it would have changed the equation all that much.
Right, right. John, are you going to miss working in Source?
It's kind of, yeah. I mean, the engine we had was very different from the original Source engine. We replaced almost every single piece of it over the 10 years at Respawn. So there's definitely that familiarity that was great, that if I needed to go change something, I knew exactly where to go look and I could make my change and know what the ramifications are, and I'll miss that. Yeah, I'm not actually sure what engine or tech stack we're going to be using.
Oh,
so
interesting.
There's a little bit of like element of fear of having looked at the same engine for 10 years, just having to go learn, you know, what else is out there now is a little intimidating.
Are you tempted to go for Source 2?
Definitely one of the ones we're evaluating. So okay. Yeah, I don't know. We have to, the truth is like me and Drew looking at an engine isn't a good way to evaluate it. We really need like art assets and animation and sound and
right,
every, you know,
right.
all the different departments to like look at it and tell us which ones they like and why.
Yeah. You could go back to the Ratchet and Clank engine from Insomniac. Weren't you guys using that for a bit for Titanfall?
Yeah. Ratchet and Clank
Future. Oh, weird. How long were you building on that?
What was the black and white?
When we started on EA, was like, hey, here's a bunch of engines we have in our archive that aren't being used. You're free to have, like, no support, whatever. We're like, cool, let's take a look. And it was Saboteur, Medal of Honor, Allied Assault, Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, I believe.
Oh, weird.
Like, Pandemic games was a lot of them.
Okay.
And it was like, okay, none of these are great current day shooter engines. And so Vince is good buddies with Ted Price. They live in the same neighborhood, I think.
Huh.
And he was like, yeah, we started our new engine and we own the engine, just not the assets. Sony owns the assets. So we'll give you the engine. You'll have to reverse engineer how to make assets because we can't give you any.
That's
and so we spent like a year in that engine prototyping stuff before we did all the cost analysis of like, okay, this is PS3 only. We need to ship on a 360 and a PC. We need to add multiplayer. We need to do this. We need to do that. We need to do this. We need to do that. And
oh,
like,
my God.
That's 20 years of man effort. Like, we can't afford that. Like, we don't have the engineering team. We don't have the time. We have people trying to make content right now. And so then we did another search, and we got a fork of Source like a week after they shipped Portal 2. We got that one because it had all the latest stuff, and it was actually, I think, 10 years ago this month that we got Source Engine.
Wow.
Or 9 years ago.
I think in the final hours, wasn't there some mention about Sony wanting you to make Titanfall for the Vita?
Oh, yeah. You always get people reaching out to you. Like, you'll get sure. NVIDIA or Sony or whoever, and they're just coming around to show you what they're working on. Like, hey, if there's an opportunity here, we'd like to work with you. And we knew PS4 and Xbox, whatever, we didn't know what they were called yet, were a couple years out, probably. I mean, we were hearing the rumblings. And Sony hit us up, like, hey, we want to come show you something. And we're like, this is it. We're going to do it. We're going to see the new PlayStation. And then they brought the Vita, and we're like, oh, but we wanted the big one. We don't want a handheld, we want a console. It was really demoralizing.
Was there any consideration about, like, maybe we could do it?
No, we were fully looking for next gen.
Oh boy. I've kept you long enough, but congratulations on the new studio. It's a very exciting adventure for the two of you, and I wish you well.
Thank you so much.
Anything else you'd like to say? Anything else you want to get off your chest about the whole experience so far? By that, I guess I mean your lives.
Making games is tough, but it's also super fun. And I don't think I could survive doing anything else at this point. So if there's people out there who are like, man, this game seems interesting, like, it is. You should put all the hard work into it and see if it's for you. It's not easy. It's often thankless, but I wouldn't do anything else.
And you were hiring, so hey, look at that.
Oh, and we're hiring, yes. Oh, I will say, like, I'm on a Discord with a group of other developers around the industry, and someone pulled a quote out from our webpage, and they're like, I hope I think this is a knock at Respawn. I was like, no. Like, I think some people think that we're trying to give the middle finger to EA or Respawn by doing this, and, like, it couldn't be further from the truth.
Oh, saying, like, we're anti-crunch, we support our employees, yeah, like that terminology.
We learned through our process at Respawn. Like, right. We're not going to do it perfect. Respawn didn't do everything perfect, but the point is, I think we're always learning. And at Respawn, we were always learning and getting better and changing processes, and we're not afraid of change. And so if there are people out there who think we're just trying to say, you know, F you to EA or Respawn, absolutely not. We got nothing but love. It's honestly been really hard not being there because those are my friends. I don't have a lot of friends, you know, around the world around me because I'm at work. I would rather, you know, be making relationships with people I work with. And so,
yeah.
Apex, or you played it right at launch but dropped it, go back and check it out. Apex is doing really cool stuff. And same goes for Jedi. If you didn't play Fallen Order, check it out. I loved playing through that game.
Yeah.
That's so sweet. Classy exit for you too. So if you had to predict who's going to buy you like 6 years from now, who's going to buy Gravity Well?
Nobody.
Nobody.
Our goal is decades. We want to make games. This is our last job. Like, we want to do this till we die. And we're not trying to make an exit, try and make a bunch of money. Like, sure, if we make a game that does really well, hopefully we make a lot of money. But our reason for this is to make a place that we like going into and making games, and we hope other people feel the same, and we just, none of us have a reason to quit or look elsewhere to get our creative desires out.
Gotcha. Well, hey, Drew and John, thank you so much, guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah,
thank you.
And that's it. Thank you so much for watching or listening to this entire interview. If you really enjoyed it, be sure to tell a friend, spread the good word about MinMax. We'd appreciate it. We're going to have more interviews coming up in the future, some with game developers, some with creative, smart people outside of the game industry. But let us know what you'd like to hear from future interviews and which interview subjects might be a good interview fit for us. All right. Thanks so much, everybody. Take care. Bye.